With spring Black Friday deals at the Home Depot, you can give your lawn or garden beds a pop of color and protection. Right now, get a special buy on Scott's Earth Grow Mulch, 5 bags for just $10. Help your soil retain moisture longer with color that lasts up to 12 months. Shop spring Black Friday deals for a special buy on Scott's Earth Grow Mulch, 5 bags for just $10 at the Home Depot. How doers get more done. Color selection varies by store. Limit 60 bags per customer while supplies last.
Dietz and Watson's been making meats and cheeses the right way since forever. What's that mean? It means never cutting corners, ever. It means cooking, not processing. It means our Virginia brand ham that's cooked to perfection, then twice baked to layer the flavors. It takes more time, but you can taste the difference. We come to work every day to do it the right way, even if it's the hard way. Because if it's not right for us, it's not right for you. Dietz and Watson, it's a family thing since 1939.
Hi, welcome to the NASCAR on NBC podcast. I'm your host, Nate Ryan, and here in Daytona Beach, Florida this week for the 59th running of the Rolex 24 at Daytona, which of course will be on NBC Sports. You can go to NBCSports.com and check out where you can watch all of the racing over the next week. And appropriate, we have a Rolex 24 at Daytona themed guest today on the NASCAR on NBC podcast. We have Laura Wantrop-Clauser, who was recently named the sports car racing program manager for General Motors Racing. And Laura, I just want to start out. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me. This is really exciting.
All right. Well, I know that you're down to Daytona Beach as well. Been an exciting week for you and the racing program. I want to get to that, but let's just start first with you were just recently named sports car racing program manager for General Motors. Prior to that, you were the program manager for GM's Cadillac DPI program in the WeatherTech Sports Car Championship Series. So just tell us about your job, your role, and how it's changed in the last week with this new position.
Sure. Yes. So by going over to be the sports car racing program manager, in simple terms, what has happened is I now have all of our sports car programs, which includes Cadillac, of course, the Camaro GT4 program, and then the big one that I just picked up with Corvette, which thrilled to be a part of that team and that program. And essentially, the role's the same, except just working with the different teams. The program manager's job at GM, we control the budget for the various programs, and that's laid out differently depending on if it's a customer program or a factory program or, you know, how we want to do that. And then we also are the single point contact for the teams back to GM and also for the chassis suppliers and engine suppliers as well. So if they have any questions or any, you know, concerns that they want to relay back, they usually go through me and then I'll take it to what I need to do, either make a decision or go above me if I need to solve a problem. And then also very much integrated into design and development of the race cars. At this point, for all of those three programs I just mentioned, the cars are done, which is exciting. So the new design and development that I'll hopefully be getting into will be anything we do for future programs, which is something that I'm involved in, you know, looking at what would we like to do from GM's perspective, where do we want to race, what brands do we want to race, all of that in the sports car arena. So it's nice. I have all different things I get to be focused on, which keeps the days different, every single one, and also keeps it so that I never get bored doing one thing.
Well, that's good. Like you said, I mean, you've added a lot to your plate here with this new role. Previously, I mentioned you oversaw Cadillac, and now you've got Corvette Racing under your umbrella as well. General question, like how many people would you say you oversee at the company? I know you work with teams, so I guess it's probably different than if you were like a team manager, but like in your role as a program manager that works with several sports car teams, how many people would you say you're overlooking here?
Oh, that's a good question. If you count the teams as being part of the family, which I very much do, even though I'm not going to go tell a mechanic what to do, that's not my job, but you know, I want to make sure that I look out for all of them. Each team is at least, you know, well, at the Rolex, they bring more people, but 20, 30 people, depending. And then what is it this year at the Rolex? We have 9 cars, 3 Camaros, 4 Cadillacs, and 2 Corvettes. So I guess if you added all that up, it's quite a few people, especially with Dallara and ECR, and then our engine team at GM included in there. But like I said, I don't really directly manage you know, what the teams do in terms of telling the mechanics how to put the wheel on or anything along those lines. It's more so just giving them the connection. And then I control the purse strings for a lot of it, especially the Corvette program. So, you know, ultimately it's like one of those love hate relationships. We have to work together to each get what we need.
Right. Well, as you mentioned, like a lot of cars you're overseeing and working with there, and you're in Daytona Beach. We're just coming off the first weekend, the roar before the Rolex 24, as it's known, the test session that precedes the sports car racing endurance classic that opens the IMSA season. And it was a really good weekend for you as the GM racing person. I mean, the Cadillacs were on top of virtually every practice session. The Action Express team of Felipe Nasr and Pipo Durrani won the Moto 100 pole qualifying race. So they will start first in the Rolex 24. And of course, they're going to be teamed with Chase Elliott, who listeners of this podcast know very well. He's been a guest, and that's brought a lot of attention to your team. You have another Cadillac team at Action Express in the number 48, which of course will have Jimmy Johnson, another past guest of the podcast here. You had Corvette Racing win the GTLM pole with the number 4 Corvette. I would presume you're coming off a pretty good 3 or 4 days here at Daytona National Speedway.
Oh, absolutely. It's been a thrill. And I am so excited for the lineup that we have across our programs. It is one of the best lineups we've ever had, especially in the Cadillac camp, right? Some of the names that are in these cars. And we have everything covered from, you know, our IMSA drivers that we know and love that have been with us, F1 drivers, IndyCar drivers, P1 drivers. I mean, we cover the gamut here. It's fantastic. So really excited to see what all of them can do in the 48 car alone, which is the one that Jimmy Johnson's in. You know, you have Jimmy Johnson coming from NASCAR, soon to be an IndyCar. You've got Kamui Kobayashi, who was in F1, and then he's been over in P1. Simon Pagenaud, obviously fantastic IndyCar driver. And Mike Rockenfeller, who is, you know, no stranger to the IMSA paddock. So right there, one car, all these different types of drivers and the backgrounds that they bring. It's going to be really neat to see what they can do. And I'm really proud of the platform there. We've enticed a lot of big names to come in and race with us. And I think it's added to the show. I hope it's gotten fan enthusiasm up, but it's also, they've done well. Alonso was in the car two years ago. I get them confused. We have so many that come through. It's such a great thing. And then, you know, just to see what they can do and hopefully bring home a win. But Wirth is thrilled, but our heads are down because we know that just because we had a successful roar does not mean that the race isn't going to be successful without being completely focused. For 24 hours, everyone has to know what their job is and they have to only be thinking about that. And I think the teams are over there right now. They're making any changes to the car. They're checking every part, making sure we have no cracks, no concerns. We've got engines going in for the 24. They're busy. And in fact, I feel kind of bad. Here I am sitting in this plush hotel room and they're over working their butts off. So I probably should go over and at least make sure to, you know, say hi and everything, because we really appreciate everything that they do.
Well, we appreciate you being here and keeping you away from your work so you can talk to the silly reporter and answer this, all the dumb questions I've got for you. But no, I appreciate that. And I appreciate your head down attitude. I mean, that's how Cadillacs probably have won 4 straight Rolex 24 at Daytona, is that you have that single-minded, laser narrow focused. But obviously, name of this podcast, the NASCAR on NBC podcast, I've got to ask what it's been like having Jimmy Johnson and Chase Elliott. As you mentioned, you guys are no stranger to having superstar drivers, champions come in the series. As you mentioned, Fernando Alonso won in the Cadillac in the 2019 Rolex 24. But you know, what's it been like having Chase Elliott making his debut, reigning Cup Series champion, Jimmy Johnson, 7-time Cup Series champion? How's it been having them around the garages?
Oh, it's fantastic. And, you know, it was funny when we had Jeff Gordon with us in 2017, that was a new experience for me. I'll be honest. I hadn't too much involvement with NASCAR. I know NASCAR and I've been to a race as a fan, but I had never been on a role similar to what I have on the sports car side. And just to see in 2017, what it was like to have someone like Jeff Gordon, it changed the dynamic of the paddock completely. In fact, I used to joke that I felt so bad for him. The poor man couldn't even go use the bathroom without having a bunch of people chasing him down to the building, which I guess explains why NASCAR sets up things the way that they do. But this year, we don't have that, unfortunately, because we don't have the fans with us, which we miss dearly. I can't wait until we go back to having, you know, fans back with us. But even still, just knowing you have someone, you know, with the caliber caliber that Jimmy Johnson and Chase Elliott bring in there on your team. And they have their own staff of people that they work with. So we have the opportunity to exchange knowledge, to talk to them about, you know, how do they do things in their side? And then what can they bring for us to learn to how to make ourselves better on our side? And I'd like to think that it's going both ways too. I'd like to think that Jimmy and Chase are picking up things on our side of the fence that might help them, you know, in their next year, with Jimmy obviously in Indy and then Chase back at NASCAR. So it's been a really pleasant experience. And of course, they're cool guys too. So that makes it fun as well.
How is it to incorporate them into the team where you know there's going to be a lot of focus and distraction, even as you mentioned, without the fans, unfortunately, being there this year? There's people like me who are obviously, you know, hyper-focused on what's going on with them. Like, how does it work where the team and GM Racing Cadillac can make them feel sort of integrated? Because I know, you know, especially for somebody like Chase, who's a very humble driver and, like you said, kind of like head down, he doesn't really want to get caught up in the hype, but naturally that's still going to be there.
Well, I'll say this. Every time I've poked my head into Action Express's trailers to check on them, I've caught Chase sitting next to either Ian Watt, their engineer, or one of the fellow drivers, and they're either poring over data over a laptop together, or they're sitting there chatting away about how to handle things. Similar experience, we've got Kevin Magnussen in the 01 Cadillac, and I had the pleasure of watching him and Ranger talk about how to drive the rain line the other day because, you know, we started the qualifying race with wet. They become one of the team. In fact, I think that I'd like to think that they just assume that they'll be out, you know, pushing the car if they need to with the mechanics like our normal drivers do. And I think that's what makes it fun, that, you know, nobody's holding them up on a pedestal or anything. They are part of the team. They are one of the three or four drivers that are going to be in the car for the race. And, you know, it's not the situation you have in some other series where it's just one driver and it's all up to them. It's literally a team sport and they all have to share what they do. Because if one of them has an incident on track and balls up the car, you know, you're affecting all these other people as well. So it's a totally different mindset. And I've been thrilled to see, it's like walking into the trailer normally, they're doing their jobs. No one's doing anything differently other than focused on winning.
Yeah. And I've heard Chase say that as well, that, you know, he doesn't want any special attention or treatment. He just wants to help these guys because they're running for a full season championship in the number 31. You mentioned as well, he and Jimmy aren't the only big stars who are in Cadillacs. You've got the new Chip Ganassi Racing Cadillac as well, that, as you said, has Kevin Magnussen coming over as a full season driver from F1. Scott Dixon, the reigning six-time IndyCar Series champion, also in that car. And as I mentioned, you've got the Mustang sampling car as well that also has done really well throughout the week in practice. So I presume, Laura, that again, like, I know you're focused on next weekend, you don't want to get too caught up in it, but the first 3 days were sort of like a dream weekend for somebody who I noticed on Instagram, you've been counting down almost every day to the Rolex 24 since January 1st, 2021. You can check out her Instagram. She's got like a photo and like a note about how many days are left to the Rolex 24? I would presume that countdown feels like very real and very satisfying.
Oh yeah. It's very much a dual experience, right? I am so excited, but I am nervous. You know, it's just everything. It's got that good butterfly energy running through. This is our race each year, right? It's crazy that we start with our Super Bowl in the IMSA racing, but this is the one that we're focused on. We get the most attention from GM leadership on this race. Although we're lucky, a lot of our leadership follow us along the entire season. They love racing. But you know, this is the one where you want to show well. And coming off of on Cadillac land, being undefeated on the DPI, we don't want to give that up. We want to hang on to that title to the bitter end. And then Corvette's got a lot to prove. You know, we launched that car last year and we were successful with the launch, but, you know, we're not going to feel like we truly got it until we're holding that championship trophy in our hands. So I'm so excited to see the race and get things going. And I'm proud of what the teams have done so far. And I told them, I said, you know, it's on you guys. This is, you know, everyone needs to hit their marks. Everyone needs to call good strategy. The drivers need to keep the car clean as long as they can, and we'll do the best that we can. And if we all contribute and we all work together, I think we all have a shot for this.
I can hear it in your voice. And I see it on social media. You obviously have such a passion for racing, Laura, and curious, we can delve a little bit into your background. And like, I know you grew up in the Baltimore, Maryland area. Did you know, I know you were a car person, but did you know much about racing growing up in near Baltimore, where, you know, I don't don't really think of that as like a racing hotbed. Like, did you know you wanted to get into racing when you start out, or was it first just kind of getting into cars?
You know, it's funny. When I think back to what my first experience with racing was, believe it or not, it was horse racing.
That's what I figured. Pimlico.
Yeah, the Preakness each year. My mother and my grandmother are not gamblers, but when it came to them horses, oof, that was a whole different story. You know, they love that stuff. And so that's what racing was to me. Yeah. But I did, I always loved cars. Pretty much ever since I was 13, I knew I was going to go and work for the auto industry. I was going to move to Michigan. I started letting my parents know pretty early. And I think it's funny. I think they knew it was going to happen. But on the flip side, when I got through college and came back and had that job offer to GM, which I had worked so hard for, and they're like, wait a minute, you're going to Michigan? Yes. Yes, I am. This is where I want to be. But in terms of racing, what got me into that on the car side was in college, I had the opportunity to be a part of the Formula SAE competition, which is really cool. That's where it's a collegiate project. It's global. And your team designs, builds, and races an open wheeled, you know, formula style race car. And it's crazy. They let these college kids freshman year through senior design this thing, build it, put an engine in it, turn it on and drive it. I mean, we did it all. It was cool. And it was an engineer's dream. It was, you took everything that you were learning in school and all those tests you were taking and all those, you know, equations you were filling out, and you did something practical with it. So I learned so much just going through that project, but really the competitive side in me was lit pretty heavy when I got through that. And, you know, we wanted to be the best, we wanted to win. And just being able to get back into racing at GM about 8 years after I had started working for the company was a dream come true. I always say that what I do here is like Formula SAE, but we finally have money to play with. So it's good.
Yeah, not exactly on the shoestring college budget anymore. Where were you at in school when you were doing that, Lauren? And what kind of car were you designing as part of the Formula SAE?
I went to Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute, which is up near Albany, New York. I got my mechanical engineering degree from them. And the car, I'd call it a spec car. They have very clear defined rules, open wheel, single cockpit. We used to run a motorcycle engine in it. We had a Honda motorcycle engine that we ran in our particular car. And then the competition was a mix of static and dynamic events. So you know, part of it was you had to create this thing like a weekend autocrosser, and you had to sell it as something that a kit that people would let you produce and you know, customers would buy, and you had to predict how many you would sell. It was all like this business opportunity. And then the dynamic portion of it was the demonstration of the vehicle. So you had acceleration event, skid pad, an autocross, and then the endurance event, which was 22 kilometers with a driver change in the middle where you had to shut the car off and then turn it back on. And it's pretty cool. In fact, I actually still volunteer for the competition today. That's one of my side projects. I run the dynamic events for SAE. And it's fantastic. The next generation of engineers that are coming through are incredible. This world has lots of good things to look forward to with everyone that's coming through. And one of the things that I'm excited about is the diversity is getting better. I can see it in the competition. You know, it went from, I was the only girl on the team, you know, we're not going to talk about how many years ago when I was in college and you know, and you go to competition and there were very few women or, you know, like I said, diversity. And now when you're at competition, that's changed a lot. I love when I see the women driving. You know, you also see different skin colors in there as well. So it's great. I'm pretty stoked about how everything's going.
Yeah, I mean, certainly that's a big part of your story. And I want to touch on that diversity and female involvement in racing too. But first, I just had a few more questions on your background. I mean, what made you become a car person? Obviously, it sounds like Formula SAE pushed you toward the racing side, but was it your parents? I think I saw a post about your dad encouraging you on the car side. Was there something that made you want to be involved with cars?
I grew up on a small farm, and to me, the license and the vehicle was a symbol of freedom. You could go out and do whatever you wanted. And in terms of getting, it's funny, my dad was interested in cars when he was younger, but the day that you opened up the hood and you really couldn't see through to the floor anymore because there was all the electronics and everything. His interest waned a little bit. He likes the old 70s and, you know, those kind of the muscle cars from back then. But it was something that it pulled on my heartstrings to know, you know, freedom, the idea of horsepower, going fast. I had a mountain bike that I grew up on that I ran the wheels off of, and it was always, can I go faster? Can I go faster? And it kind of just clicked. And then I had a lot of male friends when I was younger, and it just, I guess my personality probably meshed a little bit better than what some of the girls my age were up to. And they were always into cars or their pickup trucks or whatever in the farmland. So, you know, you picked up a lot listening to them talking and being a part of that. So it just kind of worked itself out. But it's one of those that it must have been a meant to be, because I can't imagine working on anything else.
Well, you know, like you said, you start working at General Motors, you know, pretty much right out of school. I think you worked at a co-op, started the production side. I know that you were working on Corvettes when you first started there. You've also worked on the Cadillac, the Cruze, the Encore, the Spark, a lot of production models before you moved toward the racing side about 5 years ago. Was it a natural shift with that Formula SAE experience to go from production to race cars? And it did just take a few years, several years to kind of get ingrained in GM on the production side to move over to the racing side?
Yeah, the racing opportunities at GM are, there's not many of them compared to production, right? Thousands and thousands of engineers put the cars on the roads each day. It's the racing, there's only a handful of us, but they usually want somebody who has experience in the company for several years before you come over. And a lot of that, it's building a network. You know, we want to find ways that we can integrate back into the company as best we can. And the more people that you know from the production side, the easier that is to find those synergies and to be able to, you know, call on somebody because you might have worked with them in the past, or you had familiarities because you shared a lunch table or whatever that is. But yeah, and when I actually got really lucky because of Formula SAE. When I started with GM, the first job full time, they put me on the Corvette. So I had the opportunity to really get to know the Corvette production team, which has helped leaps and bounds with coming into working on Corvette racing now and being able to connect it with them and everything. And then from there, it was what job made sense. The big three jobs at GM as an engineer is working in ABD, which is what I did with Corvette, releasing parts, which each part on a production car is owned by an engineer. I had shocks and sway bars and springs on a couple different cars. And then integration was the third area. And that's where you own a feature like noise and vibration or ride and handling or something along those lines, where you have to get all those parts, get them to work together to make the car respond the way that it's supposed to and make it a pleasure to be, you know, experience. So once I got through those three, it really was right place, right time. The racing opportunity opened up. I had a really strong background in the areas that they were looking for and threw my name in the hat to see what would happen, and got extremely lucky that they picked me for an interview and got the opportunity and it's haven't looked back since.
Yeah, that's terrific. Well, as I mentioned, so that was about 5 years ago. You started out as the program manager for Cadillac and GT3, which was sort of like a lower rung sports car series. But then in 2017, you helped with the launch of Cadillac DPI, which of course, that's the top level of sports car racing here in North America. Became the program manager there, and four straight Rolex 24 at Daytona wins. So no pressure again this year. 18 overall wins, two championships. Obviously the Cadillacs have really been the team to beat here at Daytona. And now with this new role, Lori, you're adding engineering and technical oversight of Corvette racing while still managing Cadillac on the DPI side. With Corvette being such an iconic car, I mean, this is a flagship program for GM racing for over 20 years. What's it been like adding that to your plate when you've already got all the success with the Cadillac?
Well, I'm very fortunate that there's good bones set up. You know, it's not like we're starting from scratch here. We have a very strong team. We've got a great engine in that car. We've got, you know, the strong chassis that's been built to hold it. It's really just getting in there, getting to know the people that I already was acquainted with even better. And then together deciding, you know, what does the future look like for us? Obviously we know what our current is. We're going to get out there. We're going to do the best we can. We're going to win races. We're going to bring home trophies for GM. But, you know, as we continue to build and where can we find areas of synergy between that program, the other racing programs, how can we incorporate, you know, General Motors more into this to make sure that we have all the assets that we need to continue to build this program. And then what can we bring back from racing to the company? That's been a key thing. Corvette is our best program in terms of technical learnings exchanges because the car is the most similar to the one that you buy in the dealership. So as we can continue to figure out what things did we find on racing that we can feed back into production and make sure that they address to make the production car even better. So it's always been happening, but my goal is to make it happen even better and more efficiently.
It's interesting, Laura, because you're coming in and you're replacing a guy who's kind of like a legend in racing circles. I talked to some Corvette drivers this past week, and obviously they know you from your time with Cadillac and in GM, and they have a lot of respect for you. But they also, you know, mentioned affectionately Doug Feehan, who had overseen the Corvette program for so long and actually was on this podcast a couple of years ago when I did an episode about the Earnharts, and he was very much involved in that effort. So is it intimidating at all to come in and sort of fill the shoes of someone who had been such a big part of the GM and Corvette racing effort for the last couple of decades?
Yeah. How I look at it is I'm not replacing Doug. No one can replace Doug. He is a huge part of our history. He's done so much for the program. You know, it's something that he will always have a space in Corvette, as well as the hearts of those of us who have dealt with him. And I'm fortunate to say that I know Doug. We work side by side in the IMSA paddock before, and I really hope he has a very fun retirement. I know he's got some pretty interesting cars in his own garage, so hopefully he keeps himself busy when summertime comes around. I'd like to think that, you know, I'm going to bring something a little bit different and hope that, you know, there's no replacing Doug, but, you know, we're going to see as we figure out what the future is and, you know, how can we make ourselves run in a way that makes sense across all the sports car area. But I know that there's a lot of expectations for sure. And I definitely plan to be interacting with fans. Doug was very good at that. And I'm sure they're going to be, you know, I'm have a lot to learn for sure in that area. But hopefully maybe Doug will give me a couple pointers if I ask him nicely.
Well, I mean, in those interactions, again, like, first of all, you're well-spoken. And I think like the fans would certainly gravitate toward wanting to be around you. And again, like you mentioned it, I mean, you're already sort of inherently a uniquely interesting story being a woman at this level and racing. And as you talked about, unfortunately, like when you were first getting in at Formula SAE, there wasn't perhaps that female involvement. I think it's great. As you mentioned, you've seen that grown. You know, last week with your news, Simona Di Silvestro was announced that she'll be heading back to the Indy 500 next year. Catherine Legg, another former Indy 500 starter, and Christina Nielsen, two very accomplished female drivers, announcing that they're going to run a GTD entry here at the Rolex 24 at the end of this week. So there's been a lot of significant news for women in racing recently. And just curious, and you kind of touched on it, have you seen it improve? I mean, does it seem like there are encouraging signs that there's going to be more gender equality in auto racing?
Yeah, it's definitely each year I feel like you see, you know, a couple more faces, right? And it's, none of this stuff happens overnight. A lot of the people that are in racing have been in it since they were born, or it's a family thing where they're, you know, their parents were in it, so now they're in it. So you don't see too much changeover in the paddock. It's a lot of the same familiar faces, but I think that there's a lot more opportunity now. And I'd like to think that people are not looking past things from differences perspective. You know, just because you're a different gender or you look different doesn't mean that you can't do the job. And I think that slowly we're going to start seeing more and more, just based off of, there is turnaround, and we do have some people that retire or move on to do different things. And whenever those new slots open up, I think we're going to see maybe a little bit more in terms of differences coming in. And I think that's great. And so I've been in there, I guess, 4 to 5 years. And from when I've started till now, each year you see a little bit more. And I think as long as we keep that trend, that'll be great.
Any reason that you think that you're seeing more of those opportunities for women in racing? Is it just a change in culture or mindset between the people in authority or the companies that have the ability to make those hires?
Yeah, it's really hard to say, especially because a lot of it is, they're small companies and each team is their own small company and how they do things. It's one thing when I'm talking about from General Motors perspective, right? Equality and acceptance at General Motors is one of their pillars. That's important, that we have as much of a diverse field as we can. And you can see that in the company and how that's changed. And, you know, I'm thankful to say that I've never felt different for being a woman in General Motors ever. it's been phenomenal that I can say that, because I know that not everyone has the same experience. But then when you look at smaller companies where there's only a handful of employees, it's a little bit harder. And that's where it's harder to find openings too, right? You usually keep an employee for a while. So I think it's the interest level is up. I think that, you know, women are getting more into it on the lower levels from a driver's perspective, more in karting, you know, starting to come up the ranks. And then just like you said, I think the open-mindedness is changing as well. It's the world's shifting. It happens slowly, but it is shifting. And I think as long as we don't have an expectation for who needs to fill a role, and that, you know, as long as someone comes with the talent for the job that they should be considered, then we'll be fine. And I'd like to think that overall that's happening in its own way.
Well, I know one way, Laura, that certainly helps is to have role models girls can look at and say, well, there's a woman who's working in racing. I can be like her. You have interacted with somebody who I think people this listen to this podcast would know. She's been a guest on this podcast. Alba Cologne, who is a longtime GM racing engineer, went to Hendrick Motorsports. I was looking on your website and I saw that had some photos with her. So I know you know her. And she's been a long time, I think, female role model in racing. Do you feel like you're kind of entering that sort of role and being in a more high profile job here? And is it important to sort of have examples like yourself, like Alba, for younger women?
Yeah, Alba is definitely one of my mentors. She and I met in Formula SAE back when I was a student. And then when I became a new hire at GM, Alba was always looking after the Formula SAE students that came to work for the company. And, you know, so we got to know each other well. And I miss her. She's down in North Carolina now. She used to be in Michigan. We'd see each other every once in a while. But, you know, I think it is important to see people. And something that I maybe didn't realize when I was younger, that, you know, because I knew what I wanted to do, and it didn't matter who was sitting in those roles, I was heading after it one way or another. But, you know, as I look around and I realize seeing yourself in somebody else, because they are familiar to you, their mannerisms, you know, how they look in a way, it is important for you to have something to aspire to. I went to an all-girls high school, believe it or not, and still wanted to be in engineering. But, you know, most of the girls that I were with were chasing down other roles and careers that are more traditionally female. And I think a lot of it just was familiarity. And it's, you know, that's where you headed. That's what you knew. Thankfully, I grew up in a household where the women, my mother, my grandmothers, were extremely strong. And a lot of them played traditional female roles. Both my grandmother and my mother stayed home and raised the kids. But they always were doing things with the community. They were taking leadership. My mom runs all of the money in the household. She handles the banking, all of that. And just by seeing that, you know, there were no definitions in terms of who could be doing what or what was traditional there, I think was key for me. And it's something that I didn't realize until, you know, I got a little bit older, that having that background helped set me up for what I could do. And I think that, you know, other girls, that being able to see women in the roles and say, hey, you know, she can do it, I can do it, why not? So, and that's a good thing.
Yeah, certainly having that background of making you a strong-willed, tough-minded individual can really help in racing, Laura. And Alba tells this great story about her first meetings with Dale Earnhardt. You know, he tested her in some different ways once he saw that she could handle the environment. Obviously, he respected her immensely, and to have the ear of a seven-time champion, I'm sure, was a special thing for her. From your experience, have you had instances like that? Racing, to me, like having covered it for so long, it's already a tough environment. You already have to have thick skin, I think, to be able to work in this environment. But being a woman in a male-dominated environment, is it even more different for you? Have you noticed instances in which you've been treated differently? You know, what's that been like?
You know, it's funny. It's in the moment, you don't realize anything, because you're usually handling an issue and all you're focused on is figuring out, what do I need to do to calm a person down, to get an answer out of somebody, to get us, you know, pivoting in a different direction. And you don't worry about all the background. You just, I have a job to do. I'm going to get it done. But I'm sure there are instances where I maybe had to argue or bring more fact or say something differently than had I been a man. But, you know, on the flip side, a lot of it in racing especially is relationship based. And my goal when I came over, first thing was to build strong relationships with everyone on the team, because I feel like everyone contributes in their own way, and they're all important. So it's important for me to know each and every one of them and their story and how they got into racing and you know, what's at home for them with families and stuff like that, and where their mind's at. But I think one of the benefits I have, and maybe it's a female thing or maybe it's just me, is, you know, I'm pretty personable, and I really do enjoy my minutes where I get to talk to each person and see how they're doing and what's going on in their lives and all of that. And I think by taking the opportunity to do that, it's allowed me to establish those strong relationships. So when we get into those moments where we have to make a decision quickly, or I have to tell a team, what you're doing is not okay, we can't keep doing this, you know, and all that, there's still tough moments, you know, and you do have to have extremely thick skin, because words are exchanged and emotions are exchanged. And one of the best things about racing, that's also the worst things about racing, is you have by far the most passionate people in racing, which means you get the good passion, the passion that works hard, the passion that's excited, all that. And then you get the bad passion, the anger, the things that come along when things are not going their way. And you know, you have to understand you're going to have to balance that. So it's not taking things personally, separating the personal and the business, you know, when you're having those moments, and then understanding that it's okay for people to be upset with things. You know, you have situations where you worked so hard to do something at a race and some other car hit you, or something just didn't go your way. And there's going to be anger there. And the initial response is usually to, you know, figure out, what can I blame? Why did that go wrong? You know, it's working through all that. So I think Formula SAE actually set me up pretty well for that, because I worked with a bunch of hot-headed people that I call my best friends now from college, and learning that, you know, we're going to have explosions. Things went flying across the shop. You just ducked to make sure they didn't hit you in the head. And, you know, dealing with that and just kind of translating in. So it's definitely not an environment for people that wear their emotions to the point where you can get hurt easily. You have to be able to, you know, deal with everything that throws at you, but it's great. It's the most rewarding environment for that reason, because you know, play hard and fight hard together. It's pretty cool.
Yeah. And, you know, certainly Cadillac teams have been part of some highly charged emotional situations post-race. I think people can check out Petit Le Mans last year. If they're curious about that, you can go find the highlights from that one. Any examples you have? I mean, knowing that, like, you probably can't name people or teams involved, but like, is there an example of a time where you've had to have a really hard discussion in your role right now with a race team or whoever that you can speak about generally that illustrates what you're talking about?
Oh yeah. I mean, there's definitely moments where, I was going to say a couple ones, we had tough discussions this weekend. You know, there was a situation where, the team forgot to talk to me first before they went to IMSA, which, you know, we're still figuring some of that stuff out. So it had to put a gentle reminder. The first one's gentle. The second one is not. So, and then, you know, we've had moments where teams come up with some creative solutions for things, that the way that our racing works with how the vehicles are homologated, it really doesn't allow for too much creativity from a parts perspective. Now, how you set up the car, what aero bits you choose, you can be creative there, but in terms of redesigning something, you're not supposed to be doing that. So I've had to have those conversations with teams to say, you know, the book says it needs to be this. If you go through tech and it doesn't match the book, don't come crying to me, you know, and you get in trouble. So it's, you know, you have to work through those. And then of course, IMSA and I have a lot of tough discussions. BOP is probably the worst part of racing, hands down, in terms of, you know, but it's the most important part too, because it really does keep cost under control. So, you know, I don't always agree with what they choose to do from that perspective. And we have discussions, but a lot of respect in those discussions. And I think that's important, because again, if you let your emotions get out of control with that, it really creates a mess. So we try to keep, you know, those type of things very logical, very data-driven, you know, looking at arts and charts together, not so much feelings and what my gut's telling me. And, you know, we exchange those too, but it's more what can I prove with data and those discussions. So it's, yeah, it's, I've had some interesting experiences. Thankfully, The ones that are the toughest on me actually are probably the engineers on the various teams. And I don't think that's a gender thing. Having now been an engineer for over 10 years and a couple other things, engineers always think they're right. It's just the way that we're wired. And I think you want that because some of the things that engineers do, if you think about it, everything you touch in the day was touched by an engineer at some point, your phone, the bridge you drive over, all of that. You want people that are pretty confident and know what they're doing and will call each other out because that's the only way you know you're going to have exactly the right thing. So there are times where, you know, I'll be told you're an idiot. You're not doing this right. And then I'll tell them they're an idiot too. You know, you got to have a little bit back and forth. So it's once we get through that, it works pretty well.
Got to have the hard conversations first. Yeah.
Yeah.
What's interesting about though, is that, like, as you said, I think you come off as a little bit more personable than I think a lot of people think of as engineers. And perhaps that's why you're well suited for this management and executive role. In that light, you know, just to tell people a little bit more about Laura Clauser, like in doing some research, I thought it was interesting. You have a carsandchocolate.com website. Which I guess tells people like you're not all cars. Like there's another side of you that involves like food and beer and pizza. tell me about those other interests you have in your life. And as you mentioned, your husband who also works at GM.
Yeah. Well, we're obviously car nuts. Our garage is packed at this point. We bought a house that had an attached garage and a detached garage because we had a collection and we've already outgrown both of them. It's a problem. There's no checks and balances in our relationship. If it's bad. we're Corvette owners. I have a C6 Grand Sport that we take to the track and we drive and, that's been pretty cool to see. I'm not even touching the top of what that car is capable of and it can do so many incredible things. But I do like baking. That's kind of been my creative outlet. I'm not really an artist. I don't do things along those lines, but I do like to look at the chemistry behind, you know, cupcakes and cookies and various chocolate desserts. I got into playing with chocolate a couple of years back and the molds and creating different things and stuff. And I think that the teams have benefited quite a bit from it. In fact, I love it. One of our Cadillac teams, AXR, I started when I came over, anytime any of them would win, I would send them a package down of some treat, you know, cookies or whatever I sent them and they call them wind biscuits. So they always come that they're, if they win a race, they come to tell me, we can't wait to get our wind biscuits. So I got a feeling I hope I'm going to be baking a lot this year. Cause I will happily do the same for Corvette. So, but it's a nice way to just, you know, relax a little bit, to try something new, to, you know, come up with things. And usually people are excited when you bring treats into the office or, you know, share them with the teams. Or my husband is always happy when the kitchen's up and running so he can come sample whatever's coming out of the oven.
That's great. Yeah, certainly you need those de-stressors when you're working in such a high pressure environment on the job. It's good to have all these things away from the job. And you mentioned those wind pastries and cookies. Looking ahead to next weekend, again, trying to win 5 in a row on the Cadillac side with Rolex 24. And I know the Corvette has a new C8R that won the championship last year, but didn't get the Rolex 24. You know, you mentioned that you get nervous about things. You know, what are you most worried about as you look toward Rolex 24 next weekend and think about, you know, how do I get Cadillac and Corvette both in victory lane?
Well, I think all of us across the field are nervous about sharing the track. There's a lot of cars on the track for this race, and we've got different classes. Some of them are integrated into others. In fact, LMP3 and GTLM seem to be running pretty close to each other, depending on who's in the cars. And it's just, you hope and you pray that you stay out of scuttlebutts, because there's always that opportunity. You could have done everything perfect, but you were just in the wrong place at the wrong time. And somebody's bad decision became, you know, the thing that took you out. So I think that's for sure. We're all nervous about that. And you're nervous about that any race, because anyone can have a situation where they have a brain fart or the weather catches them off guard or something along those lines. And it causes an issue. So I think the drivers know that a good portion of the race is just keeping your nose clean and keeping out of that stuff. But then, you know, also I'm responsible for the hardware through the suppliers that do that. And I want those race cars to end that race just as tough as they started it. And I think that, you know, we've proven we can. We just need to make sure that it's all ready to go and the teams have all the resources they need available to them. They have any technical expertise if they, you know, for how they want to set up the car and all of that. And we're just working through all those things. And then the fun part is when the green flag starts, it's out of my hands and in theirs. And that's where I just keep my fingers crossed that they stay focused. And I know they can, because they've proven it over and over again.
And they'll get another chance to prove it. 59th Rolex 24 at Daytona coming up. Laura, really appreciate giving us so much of your time. Good luck with the race. Good luck with the 2021 season. Good luck in your new role. And thanks again for being here.
Thank you so much for having me. And thank you to all the fans. We love you. We can't wait for you to be back in the paddock.
Our thanks again to Laura Wantrop-Clauser for joining the NASCAR on NBC podcast ahead of the Rolex 24 at Daytona. And also want to say thanks as well to Ryan Smith at Corvette Racing, who helped set up this conversation with Laura. And thanks as well to my NBC Sports colleague, Emily Conboy, who helped ensure that this recording went smoothly. This was done remotely over Zoom, which is not normally how I record these podcasts. And Emily was there to guarantee that I didn't screw up the audio or the video from this conversation. We will have a video clip from this podcast that will be available on the Motorsports on NBC YouTube channel. So if you enjoyed hearing the podcast, you want to watch some video, both of our conversation and probably some highlights as well from Cadillac and Corvette Racing, you can go to the Motorsports on NBC YouTube channel and check out a video clip from this episode of the NASCAR on NBC podcast. As I mentioned, Laura manages the Cadillac program, which is vying for its fifth consecutive overall victory in the Rolex 24. And she now also manages the Corvette Racing program for Chevrolet. Corvette Racing is the defending series champion in the GTLM division and is trying to get its first victory in the Rolex 24 with the C8R model that made its debut last year. So as I mentioned, these are a very busy 2 weeks for Laura, and we really appreciate her squeezing in some time to do the podcast and give us a lot of insight into her career and the teams that will be fielding Jimmy Johnson and Chase Elliott in Cadillacs for the Rolex 24 at Daytona. I was just looking at the entry list for this race, and this is an absolutely star-studded field of driver talent and championship-level teams. I promise I'm not just blowing smoke as an NBC Universal employee when I say that. The depth of this year's Rolex 24 at Daytona is truly amazing. You've got Daytona 500 winners, you've got Indy 500 winners, you've got the reigning series champions in the NTT IndyCar Series and the NASCAR Cup Series. As I mentioned, you've got Chase, you've got Jimmy, you've got Scott Dixon, Alexander Rossi, Simon Pagenaud, Elio Castroneves, Juan Pablo Montoya, Austin Dillon, AJ Allmendinger, and then there are all the usual sports car stars as well. There are a ton of big names in this race. And if you want to check out all the action, NBC Sports has 24-hour coverage of the Rolex 24 at Daytona starting Saturday, January 30th, at 3:30 p.m. Eastern on NBC. And you can go to nbcsports.com/motors for a full broadcast schedule of how to watch all the action from this year's race. I've also got links to our full broadcast schedule that are in the posts I've been writing about the Rolex 24. You can find updates on what Chase Elliott's teammates think of his acclimation to sports cars. They're highly impressed. What Jimmy Johnson and Chase Elliott are facing coming in the Rolex 24. Already some rivalries brewing among the top-level DPI cars. Some sniping going on among the Cadillac and Acura and Mazda teams. So a lot of good stuff to check out at nbcsports.com. Also, you can check out my Twitter feed. I will have links and information as well there, too, if you're interested in watching the race. So this is the first NASCAR on NBC podcast of what I hope will be many in the 2021 season as we try to get things fired up here again. 2020, of course, was a very challenging season in many ways, so we didn't get to do as many episodes of the NASCAR on NBC podcast as I had anticipated, but I'm hopeful of changing that this year. I'm planning on doing post-race podcasts with our analysts, our NASCAR on NBC analysts, starting with the Daytona 500. And I'd like to do some more guest and narrative episodes this season as well. So if you have suggestions for guests, ideas, please send them my way and stay tuned for more news on that. The NASCAR on NBC podcast is available on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Play, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Please feel free to leave a rating and review. Say that you're glad maybe that the podcast is back. That always helps in spreading the word and building the audience, which of course helps me out. And as always, again, you can send me feedback on Twitter, @NateRyan is my handle. Thanks again for listening to the NASCAR on NBC podcast.
Doers, mowing season is here with Spring Black Friday savings at the Home Depot. Right now, you can get gas like power with the Ryobi 40-volt push mower for just $329. With a runtime of nearly an hour, it's the perfect mower to tackle your half-acre lawn without a trip to the gas station. Just push and mow. Your grass won't wait, so buy it online and pick it up in-store to get out there sooner. Get gas like power this spring with the Ryobi 40-volt push mower, just $329 during Spring Black Friday at the Home Depot. How doers get more done. Dietz and Watson's been making meats and cheeses the right way since forever. What's that mean? It means never cutting corners, ever. It means cooking, not processing. It means our Virginia brand ham that's cooked to perfection, then twice baked to layer the flavors. It takes more time, but you can taste the difference. We come to work every day to do it the right way, even if it's the hard way. Because if it's not right for us, it's not right for you. Dietz and Watson, it's a family thing since 1939.